Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, January 16th. We hear from the governor on the sudden change at the helm at the Department of Law Enforcement. Governor Green also talks about addressing homelessness and falling vaccine rates, why he may be headed back to the nation's capital this month. We talk about setting the tone as new leadership takes the helm in the House, and the Republicans finally settle on a minority leader. We hear from the author of a new book, California Against the Sea, and how its lessons might apply here in the islands. And we track the progress of the Ulu Cooperative in generating buzz about breadfruit. Could it turn up in cafeterias on school lunch trays? You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This week, following a big news conference on Monday addressing fireworks enforcement, we learned that the director of the Department of Law Enforcement, Jordan Lowe, stepped down. This morning, we got a chance to talk to Governor Josh Green about the sudden announcement that Lowe is being replaced by Honolulu Police Major Mike Lambert at such a critical time.
Jordan Lowe is a very good guy. I so appreciated his work for 2 years. And as we reach this two-year halfway mark of our term, there's going to always be some change. We have thanked Jordan. He's going to stay in the administration for some time, continuing doing law enforcement. But Mike Lambert, who is a deeply respected community member, who's been a high-level officer at HPD, is going to be coming in. I worked with Mike really closely as we started the first Kauhales and the Joint Outreach Center in Chinatown when I was lieutenant governor. He comes highly recommended, and he will fit in very nicely as we take the next step with the Department of Law Enforcement. We will be amping our work on fireworks. You saw that we recommended some changes where people will just also be eligible for citations, up to $300 citations like tickets. I think that's going to make it easier for law enforcement to, send a message on New Year's Eve or on 4th of July if people are setting off dangerous fireworks. So there's that. Plus, because of the tragedy and the sheer scope of the tragedy, if someone takes another person's life or someone dies even accidentally, we will be able to increase the penalties into Class B and Class A felonies if legislation passes. So that's where we are right now. I actually think it's likely that just the basic ticketing will be impactful because that's what people they'll understand well. But I just humbly ask everybody, look, I love fireworks too, but we can't be lighting them off anymore. They are too significantly hazardous, and we've seen a lot of injuries. This year, we had 24 people critically injured in the large explosion in Salt Lake. But, last year, 8 people lost part or most of their hand. That's a terrible set of injuries for our citizens, and those were self-inflicted wounds. So, we really have to change things, and I'm going to also authorize our teams to have more public fireworks shows, which hopefully will kind of take down some of the pent-up need for those performances. There's just a lot of things that need to be done, and we will get advice from the past directors now, but we're also moving forward with some new blood.
Well, it was a good sign that so many people did show up on Saturday to turn in their unexploded fireworks. So that was a good thing, because it's so dangerous to have these things sitting around, particularly if they're unstable.
Yeah, we had over 120 people came in and turned in fireworks. We also recouped like over 1,300 pounds of fireworks. Over the last couple of years, we've brought in 240,000 pounds of fireworks. But obviously, this New Year's was an indication that there's so much out there that that's just the tip of the iceberg. We have to ask people to not import them at all. Of course, it's illegal, but we're going to put some extra enforcement in. The mayor and I are working on that. We're going to put extra technology in place so that we can catch people who have been shipping them in. I think that's a lot of the problem. And I know it's been lucrative for individuals, but the tragedy greatly offsets any activity that people have been doing for their own finances. Again, it's illegal, so please don't do it.
Well, you know, we did have Major Lambert in along with Jordan Lowe talking about fireworks enforcement. So, yes, I mean, Major Lambert is certainly very capable. I don't know if there's anything, you know, you can say about Jordan's resignation. And is the deputy still there, or, you know, how does that work going forward?
Yeah, the deputy's still there, and then ultimately there will probably be some restructuring of the leadership team. In general, I ask the directors to pick their own deputies. So when Lambert comes in, he'll have that prerogative. But, you know, I have a lot of respect for all of them, and there's so much work to be done in other places. It's just, like I said, sometimes you need new blood. And the sheriff's office had wrestled with some challenges in transition. I think everyone acknowledges that. And I'm a believer that every 2 years you take a look, see where people are at their best, and you try to find better spots for them if they, you know, are good people, but it's not, you know, working 100%. And that was the case. But also, I think it was exhausting for Jordan Lowe, because building a department while having to not be in conflict with other departments who were worried about their responsibilities. There was always some tension between the Department of Law Enforcement and the Honolulu Police Department, what their roles were going to be, you know, who was going to be policing the streets. All those things contributed to some of the, you know, the overall conflict. And I don't like conflict. I like people to be able to be at their best and work effectively. And so I think some change is good. We've had very little change actually overall in our administration, especially at the director and deputy director level. So there's going to always be a little bit of change, you know, in administrations, and
well,
that's this one.
Well, you know, I know there was some concern about the proposal for a highway patrol, you know, which in reading stories that, you know, HPD wasn't really in line with that. So I don't know. Do you think Major Lambert will have any issues or any pushback within the department? You know, because there's always been that tension between HPD and the sheriff's department.
Well, you know, I have not yet authorized that as a role for DLE, and I'm going to make sure that, you know, the Honolulu Police Department is on the same page with them. So I don't think there'll be a problem. It's interesting because both Mike Lambert and the current chief of police were competing for that job at the same time. I was actually a reference for both of them. I hold them both in high regard. So I don't think we're going to have an issue. I think really there's just so much work to go around. When you look at the importation of the fireworks, when you look at fentanyl that's coming into the state, when you think about the challenges we've had with gaming rooms, all of these things, not to mention the fact that we've got challenges on the streets with homeless individuals and all the enormous challenges that the Hawaii Police Department has to face, I think there's just so much effort that's needed to go into public safety that having, you know, several elite people on the job, it will work. I will expect they should not fight at all.
Well, you know, you brought up the situation with homeless. I was surprised to learn that the point in time count that Partners in Care is about to launch will not include the homeless. It will only include those in shelters. I don't know. Do you know what brought that about?
I was told it was an even year, odd year thing where they were going to be doing every other year. We are going to get samples from across the, you know, across the county anyway, and we're going to continue to make sure that our Cal Hawley program is getting people off the streets. It seems to really be working, honestly. I can only tell these kind of one-off stories, right? But I know that they will do it at least every other year, and that's enough of a baseline for me. I'm going forward no matter what with this four-year plan to get to 30 Cal Hale over the course of our term in office, and if I'm fortunate enough to be given a second term, you know, in the governorship, then we will increase the scope of each of them and continue to increase services. But we'll get at least 1,500 chronically homeless individuals into Cal Hawley's, and then they go on to permanent housing a lot of the time. So it's a good system. It supports a lot of the other work that people have been doing with Housing First. We're getting indications that the legislature is pleased with our funding requests and actually may increase them in some ways for long-term housing as a part of this Cal Hawley movement. And that would include, you know, some long-term housing and other resources that the Revolving Housing Trust Fund's been able to offer. So it's just a good thing overall. And I hope that people see the compassion in creating villages where people live in a community rather than either being just kind of swept and then coming right back, or some people just aren't really ready to go into permanent housing. And we've seen that and heard that from the houseless community. They've often told me that they get put into an apartment and they immediately leave because of the isolation. And I understand, because I've talked to a lot of people, you know, thousands of people that are homeless, and that is one of the refrains.
Well, we plan to talk to Laura Thielen tomorrow on the show, you know, just to better understand the scope. I wasn't sure if anything had happened where they, you know, maybe didn't have enough people to do the count as we've done in the past. But I just would think that, you know, you want the best data to make decisions about our homeless crisis and housing crisis.
Yeah, I defer to them. You know, I would love the data, but I'm comfortable in the knowledge that our program is working and that we at least need to finish this 4-year approach to homelessness. A lot of times we get into a contentious state and then change too quickly and we don't finish, you know, the strategic plan. And like finishing the statewide housing plan is important. Finishing the homeless plan for social health is important. And then, you know, we'll see where we have to adjust. But I look forward to hearing what she has to say, and we're going to support her no matter what.
That was Governor Josh Green, who we talked to earlier this morning. We will be back to hear more after a short break. Let's return to our interview with Governor Green, who we talked to this morning. The governor recently returned from Washington, D.C., where he testified against the confirmation of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as part of President Donald Trump's cabinet because of his anti-vax views. We asked Green about concerns that he has about the falling vaccine rates in our schools.
Please, please, please get your children vaccinated, because if we lose critical mass of our vaccination statewide, we will not have immunity, called herd immunity, and lots of outbreaks will occur. Remember, children under age one are not even eligible for measles, mumps, rubella shots, which means if we have a decrease in vaccinations among school-age kids and adults, those people will be vulnerable, these little people. So that is really worrisome. I'm likely to have to go back to Washington, D.C. the week after next. It appears that I'm being invited by the committee to testify, and in fact, just requested to testify. It turns out that RFK Jr. did some bad things. He misrepresented what he was doing. He said he did not engage in dissuading Samoa from being vaccinated. Well, he got paid $2.2 million by the Children's Health Defense, the organization he started, $2.2 million to actually represent and be an anti-vax leader. And that is what is translating across our country, because people spread misinformation about COVID vaccinations or routine childhood vaccinations, the percentages drop 5, 10, 15%. And when that happens, you get outbreaks. And that means ultimately you will see measles outbreaks, you will see polio outbreaks again, which is completely tragic. There's just really a lot of concern about this. And unfortunately, you know, I have nothing against RFK Jr. From a human perspective, he should probably be an environmental leader. That's the kind of thing he's trained for. But under no circumstance should he be a health secretary.
Well,
so his health secretary position, or the potential position, will doom us to outbreaks for our kids.
And will that trip happen after the State of the State?
Yeah, it would happen the week after. I'd probably go for 2 days, 2.5 days maybe.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't love getting on a plane flying to the East Coast. Believe me, I much prefer to be here. I will always work remotely, but if I get called by the U.S. Senate to testify, I'll have to do it. So I really feel strongly that I need to advocate for our country and our state, most importantly for me, but for all of our people, to make sure we have good public health. And everyone knows that that's central to what we have to be. We've saved over 150 million lives over the last 50 years with vaccinations, and I can't imagine losing so many of these beautiful people that we care for here in our state and across the country because we don't follow science.
Yeah.
So we have to do that, and you know, I just think America has to be a little bit more mindful of misinformation. I'm disappointed that government, at least this new government, is embracing that. And let's just use common sense, you know, take care of people. But Mr. Kennedy is not one of the people that we can trust to protect our children. So,
well, Governor, on the state of the state, I don't know, can you throw us any crumbs? Anything you might highlight? I understand that there's a report out about liquefied natural gas. Do you plan to include that in your talk?
No. That's going to come out a couple weeks later. You know, we're still having the discussions, and I don't have the final report, but we do have, you know, the earlier drafts of a really terrific study, and I'm just going to put out the study information and see what people think. That's the approach I will take on energy. I do think that we overall have to make sure that energy is less expensive, and we need a bridge to fully renewable energy. And no one has put a plan out there in the last 15, 20 years to have a perfect bridge to the future. Because if I do humbly ask the people to, you know, accept different energy strategies, it's for the purpose of getting to fully renewable sooner. And I want to replace oil. That's important. You know, replacing oil, crude oil, is critical because it's completely destructive to our environment. So I'm going to ask everybody to be analytical about this. But for my State of the State speech, I'm going to speak mostly about housing and homelessness and probably public safety. I want to stay focused on the top priorities that we have, and it's affordability and housing with, you know, some early education and some health care. I will stay very focused on that and give everyone the update.
Okay. Anything on the agriculture front?
There always is, actually. And on agriculture, one of the places we expect to have a real boost to local ag is on food security. Jamie and I are working together as the first family on a five-year plan for food sustainability. I do want to share with people that we are not going to support any increases in the cost of lunches for kids. So when that is proposed or talked about, I won't be letting that go forward to the extent that I have the power to stop that. We want free lunches for every kid, and we want a five-year plan for that. But in order to do that, we want to enhance our local ag so that ag can supply all that food, good farm-to-school programs. We've asked for this new deputy superintendent that works directly on food, and that's how we're headed on ag. So it's a great place to use local agriculture. We have about 165,000 children that get lunch every day. We want fresh vegetables, fresh foods there, fresh meats from Hawaii. And it's kind of a double win, if you will, if we do that.
That was Governor Josh Green talking to us this morning about vaccination rates in our schools, among other things. He shared that he has been invited back to the nation's capital to testify again at the confirmation hearings for RFK Jr. as head of the Department of Health and Human Services. HPR's government reporter Ashley Mizzou was down at the state capitol covering the opening session yesterday. She joins us now to talk about the tone set with new faces in leadership positions. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, so I think this legislative session, you know, housing and insurance stabilization are really going to be the big themes kind of this legislative session. You know, that really shouldn't come as a huge surprise, as most people would categorize housing as the number one issue that the state faces. Senate President Ron Cochi, in his opening remarks, says many of the state's problems can be traced back to the lack of housing.
No, there's a lot of you out there who are still fighting to get your children home or your grandchildren home. And the obstacle is the housing, but that's why we need the investment in the infrastructure. We need to get through the permitting process and build the units faster, because this housing affects everything we're trying to do in this economy, everything in what we're trying to do in creating a better life for all of us here in Hawaii.
You know, Governor Josh Green has requested a $250 million investment into housing. And, you know, Cochi says because the state is in good financial shape, it's something that the legislature should be able to do, if not more. House Speaker Nadine Nakamura says investments into more affordable housing will be top of mind for lawmakers on the House side, as well as they try to address the cost of living in Hawaii, you know, like adding more funds for housing for families, but making between 60 and 140% of the annual median median income, because she says those projects will need government subsidies to get off the ground because of the high cost to build here. And compounding on the state's housing shortage, insurance premiums on condominiums, and now some homes have become increasingly challenging for owners to find and afford. And so Senator Jarrett Kehoe-Kalole, who chairs the Consumer Protection Committee, says the future for insurance is even more uncertain following the devastating fires in LA. And that's why lawmakers will need to consider measures to establish a state insurance model that homeowners could possibly use as a last-ditch effort.
We have limited resources in state government, so we can't guarantee that prices will be at the levels that homeowners are accustomed to. But what we don't want to do is leave homeowners to the four winds to have to access unregulated out-of-state insurance from anywhere around the world. We want to try and make sure that they have options available in Hawaii.
And, you know, this isn't necessarily house and home insurance that would replace, you know, other insurances. This is when, for people who are in situations where they cannot get an insurance provider to provide them insurance. And so usually now, if you cannot get that here in Hawaii, you would have to go on this unregulated market where the prices are just like skyrocketing, like horridly high because it's an unregulated market. And so the state is saying that possibly they would step in to provide that last ditch effort for families who need it. Mm-hmm. However, it wouldn't be the same cost as if you got a regular insurance policy here. It would be elevated. And so it's kind of more of like a stopgap than necessarily like replacing home insurance in Hawaii.
Right. And then there's that task force that's looking at those issues.
Exactly. I think that task force is really what influenced the type of legislation we're about to see in this session regarding the stabilization of the insurance market here. Senator Kehoe-Kalole says, you know, in the long term, homeowners will need to harden their homes and make them more fire resistant to build more security within the housing market. And, you know, one of the ways that Governor Green has wanted to address this is through two funds that equal about $2 billion that would go towards, one would go to climate resiliency, and then another would make direct payments to households in natural disasters. He's suggesting using the interest from the state's $1.5 billion rainy day fund to do this. But House Finance Chair Kyle Yamashita was hesitant about touching the state's reserves due to, you know, different types of fluctuations in the economy. And he noted that it's been a decade since the 2008 recession, but then we had the pandemic and now there's inflation. And so it's just an uncertain. And so he is really hesitant to touch any of those reserve funds that the state might be building.
Yeah. And then, you know, we're hearing about, you know, historic homes that, you know, folks have had their insurance canceled because it's wooden structure or single wall. You know, we're hearing about townhomes that are, you know, getting dropped, you know, and then it's very scary when you think of Los Angeles and how all those homes were dropped as well by their insurance carriers.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of uncertainty too about, you know, how those LA fires are going to affect the insurance market here, because that's going to reverberate, you know, throughout our state as well. Another thing that lawmakers brought up was Speaker Nakamura says there are really two big financial unknowns looming over the session. One is whether or not the $4 billion Maui wildfire victim settlement, of which the state would contribute $800 million, is going to go through. That's being held up in the courts right now, about, you know, insurance providers. And depending on what decision the court makes on that case that is in front of them about this settlement, it could all fall apart and we'll be back to square one. And that could dramatically increase the amount of costs on the state and the other, you know, major stakeholders in that settlement for payouts.
A lot at stake there.
Exactly. And so that's one of the major unknowns. And then the second involves impacts to federal funding under President-elect Donald Trump, who will take office on Monday. You know, we've looked into this at HPR about what the cuts would mean for Medicaid, climate funding. So you can find that on our website, too, if you're interested. Other things to kind of look out for: recreational marijuana legalization is also back on the table. House Judiciary Chair David Tarnas has put together the bill. You know, the last 2 years, it's sailed through the Senate and then has failed in the House both times. And so, you know, this time maybe because it's getting put together on the House by the chair of the Judiciary Committee, it might have a better shot at getting through the House this time. And agriculture investments are also another topic that's been top of mind for lawmakers. The House leadership, you know, said that it's important to make those investments in local farming. Another thing that we're kind of going to be watching is about the governor's climate fee that he's been trying to propose over the last couple of years and the different iterations of that. The House leadership was not super enthusiastic about creating new fees. However, they said they are open to exploring raising the 10.25% hotel tax, TAT tax, or increasing fees at state parks. And they said anything they do has to be really easy to implement, and they're not really looking to set up a new fee structure.
You were also covering the council revenues. You were tracking that. So what's the outlook for our coffers?
Yeah, so the Council on Revenues actually gave a really optimistic outlook for the state's revenue this year, and that's due to a really huge bump from an estate tax collection that was likely due to the death of one extremely significant wealthy person that bumped up our state revenue kind of dramatically. So the state is coming in with a massive carryover balance, which is, unspent money from last year at $1 billion. But we have to realize that, likely this is going to change in the out years as the income tax cut that they passed last session ramps up. So this bump in revenue that the council has predicted is kind of like a one-time thing,
right?
Because of the estate tax.
Yeah, well, we'll see how long that money lasts. And I know, we've got new leadership, new faces in some posts, particularly the House Speaker, First Women.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, this, along with, the new speaker, we've also have an actual minority caucus in the Senate. Senator Brenton Awa's speech on the floor yesterday was very explosive. He called out all the leaders in state and city government. And he's now the minority leader of the Senate. And so here's a clip from his speech.
I don't want to be the one to keep Governor Green from helping California fire victims, but if he wants to fly them in and offer hotel rooms for free, what if we offer that to all the Hawaiians who've been displaced up there? All the people who used to live here who are now displaced. What if we be the bridge to bring them back? What if we took care of our own?
And then there was a one no vote from Representative Kim Koko Iwamoto to appoint Representative Nadine Nakamura as Speaker of the House. One of those main issues is Representative Iwamoto says that Speaker is not necessarily following the rules of the House by appointing Vice Speaker Ichiyama to committees, which she's not supposed to have a vote on that. And so basically, we're seeing kind of this change in the House rules that people are pushing for more transparency, and the House has not really said whether or not they're going to change the rules or what's going on there. They've been really, really quiet about how that's going to work. And so this no vote kind of signified, I think, Representative Iwamoto, pushing back on kind of that secrecy there of what's going on with the rules and some of the issues within there. And so those are kind of the two things playing out in the House and the Senate.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that she would pick this on the first day, since the House Speaker did, note that she was the first transgender lawmaker.
Yeah, I think that, she's really a maverick in that way, that she's willing to kind of speak out when she feels that things are not what she would like to see.
Yeah, so we'll see how that all plays out for the rest of the session. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's Ashley Mizzouo. Look for her government stories on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Let's face it, life gets busy, but you don't want to miss out. HPR makes it easy to stay connected. Introducing the Akamai Recap. It's a quick roundup of local news stories sent to your inbox every weekday afternoon. It's free, and it takes just 10 seconds to sign up. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/akamai.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. On view now, Satoru Abe, Reaching for the Sun, featuring 70 years of the Hawaii artist's paintings, sculptures, drawings, and prints. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Climate change is certainly dominating the headlines, with fire and water events sweeping across the country of late. Today, we're featuring author and climate journalist Rosanna Shaw. She covers environmental issues for the Los Angeles Times. Her new book is entitled California Against the Sea. It's her first trip to Hawaii. It's part of a University of Hawaii Better Tomorrow speaker series. And she joined us this morning, along with McKenna Kaufman, the director for the UH Institute for Sustainability and Resilience. Kaufman starts us off.
So I read Rosanna's book last year. It was recommended to me by a student studying sea level rise in California. And she said, there's this really great book out and you really need to read it. So, okay. So I got it and I read it and I was blown away. It really resonated with me about, you know, the issues going on in California and just so much of the similarities. You know, even there are clear differences between the coasts and the development patterns, but like the similarities between the kind of on the ground policy issues and the trade-offs we're facing really resonated. And so I started saying to everybody, you know, in my research program, you guys have to read this fabulous book. The other part about it is just the clarity with which Rosanna wrote the book and told California's story about sea level rise and sea level rise policy, which is why I started, everybody needs to read this book. And as I was having those conversations, then it was galvanized around, you know what, let's bring her out. Let's bring her to Hawaii so we can, you know, focus on her book, but also the story of sea level rise and the communication of sea level rise and impacts for Hawaii.
And Rosanna, you're from LA, and you know, we're all watching the wildfire drama just unfold. But you know, we're talking about the impacts of climate change, and they're very real. You know, I understand you had a chance to go around the island here on Oahu. I don't know, what were you struck by as you think of, you know, the changes that are happening and the reality that we're living with now?
Yeah, thank you. And I'm just so grateful to be here. And I've been so blown away by every single person I've met at the university and in Hawaii so far. And McKenna, I'm just so touched to hear what you said about the book. I'm just really, really inspired by all the work that you're doing to connect all of these dots. You know, McKenna and I were reflecting a lot yesterday. I mean, this conversation on sea level rise and climate change more broadly started out as a very like wonky science conversation based in modeling and the abstract. And as more researchers and experts in all these different fields of expertise, political science, economics, sociology, and even psychology, like I think it's just become this richer, more dynamic conversation that can actually help move a lot of these policy conversations forward. And yeah, I was just so, my mind is still exploding from everything that we saw yesterday. I mean, we went all the way to the North Shore and just seeing all these parallels between what's happening in California and all of the questions that so many communities, coastal communities in Hawaii are now wrestling with, thinking about, starting to think about. And I think one thing that really stood out to me as we were walking along the North Shore was just kind of this notion that we still so often think of these disasters as one-offs, right? A home falls into the ocean, everyone freaks out. We deal with it, we respond, we try to get back to normal as soon as possible. We point fingers at each other briefly, and then the sun keeps shining, and then we move on. And then we become surprised all over again when another house falls into the ocean. And so, you know, how do we start to step out of these parcel by parcel, single example approaches and start to think bigger picture about what it is that we're responding to overall?
And then you talked about planning differences and similarities between California and Hawaii. I'm thinking of, okay, like Waikiki and our economic engine and tourism, and those hotels out there are having to think about what is our future going to look like.
Absolutely, right? So, I mean, I think it's really important to sort of know that sea level rise is, you know, it's a future event, but it's also a today event, right? We're already experienced the impacts of sea level rise. And so when we think about like Waikiki, right, we're already experiencing, you know, tremendous amounts of groundwater inundation and the number of sort of like high tide, you know, events that become, you know, start as nuisances, then become real hazards, right? Those days are increasing. And that is kind of the way we're going to experience sea level rise, right? And so in a place like Waikiki, it really starts to impact the underground infrastructure first. So there are wonderful researchers at the University of Hawaii who have done a lot of work in this space, Shelley Habel in particular. I lean on her and ask her tons of questions about groundwater inundation all the time. And we have a project together, actually. There's a group of interdisciplinary researchers where we're looking at kind of a combination of groundwater inundation, economic modeling, and engineering responses to think about what are those triggers when we can think about different kinds of infrastructural stressors, you know, leading to failures that then we need to do something different, right? Like, for example, raise the road. And how do we do that on the whole scale of Waikiki, not just one parcel?
And then we were talking with folks over at the harbor, and they've got, you know, massive modernization monies that are being spent to help our resiliency. You know, they're raising the piers, I don't know, 3 feet. I don't know if that's enough, but those kinds of things. And I'm sure in California, those are some of the very same issues that they're facing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like, do we have to wait until 3 feet or 3.5 feet of sea level rise to do something? I think what McKenna just said, this notion of, you know, the increasing frequency in which these flood events are happening. You know, a scientist in California posed to me once, you know, at what point, if a critical road that we rely on to get to school and work in the hospitals, you know, at what point if a road, critical piece of infrastructure, a home, a neighborhood is flooding, you know, every winter or even like once a month or even twice a year, like, is that place essentially already underwater? Like, do, like, and needs to, and we need to rethink or at least recalibrate how it is that we want to adapt to our relationship to the ocean there, you know, rather than wait until that scary flood line moves all the way on this 2D static flood map and, you know, this is now underwater. And I think what McKenna also just said reminded me, like, our baseline for normal keeps shifting. And I think that's something I kept coming across in the process of talking to communities and people who are thinking about this issue, both long-term and short-term. And, you know, even yesterday on our, just I was, as McKenna, you were taking me to all these places on Oahu, like the beach used to be there and now it's here, but people forget or people have recalibrated their sense of what the beach is supposed to look like. And that kind of shifts our sense of time and it deludes us into thinking that we have more time to continue to respond.
I think you're right though, because it's, you know, we are on the edge and the edge keeps shifting. And, you know, when we think of roads to get in and out of communities, you know, like we saw in Lahaina with, you know, then the threat of wildfires. And obviously here on Oahu, we're dealing with the erosion over there on the windward side, you know, near Haula. And there's been talk about building, you know, another road, right? Because communities need another path to get out of harm's way if need be. And is there any, I don't know, any place in LA that, you know, that you think of in those terms?
I mean, as we were driving along the coastal highway, I don't know if you call it a highway here, but it may, I kept thinking about Pacific Coast Highway. I mean, the notion of driving in a convertible down Pacific Coast Highway is such a like California thing, right? And but then you look at all the coverage of the highway in Big Sur keeps collapsing, and in Malibu, it's now become kind of our first line of defense, quote unquote, against the ocean. And these roads have also kind of created this what folks call a feedback loop. You know, we created the road, which allowed more people to build homes and infrastructure and communities on these roads. And now because these communities are there, we rely on the road to stay open in order to keep business as usual. And kind of we're stuck in this repeating cycle of needing to maintain the status quo. But is the status quo what we actually want to continue holding the line on? I think that's a very big philosophical question that a lot of folks are now asking in California. But it is really hard to let go of these things that we hold so dear to like our sense of identity and what we love. And I think we so often see change as a bad thing, but and something that we have to protect ourselves against. But I think, you know, I'd love to gently encourage more people to think about whether or not change could be a good thing if we are intentional about it and proactive about it when we still have time to, you know, rethink about what it is that we actually want for our shorelines.
And, you know, I'm a big resiliency person. I just think you can't do enough to prepare. Because, you know, when you see the strength of Mother Nature, when you look at her power, and gosh, that power is changing. It's becoming more ferocious, you know, with the winds that we saw whipping around, you know, those fires in Los Angeles. But I don't know, any thoughts about resiliency and our shorelines?
Absolutely. So, you know, there is this aspect of resiliency, which is really like, how do we recover from stresses and events, right? And those are getting more, as your point, Catherine. And we're also losing some of our sort of, you know, key ecological functions that help us keep coastal resiliency, which are our coral reefs. But that really helps with sort of calming wave energy, right, and keeping at bay some of those events. That said, it's also in my mind, like there's a resiliency story, but there's also a, what do we want to prioritize in, you know, what we think of as a healthy coastline, right? Hawaii has lost so much. We're experiencing a crisis of beach loss. So is that a trend that if we, you know, want to keep the status quo, where, you know, there's research suggesting that if we keep the status quo, we're going to lose half of our beaches by mid-century, right? I don't want to lose half of our beaches by mid-century. So the status quo really can't be the path we stay on. So again, the conversation of how do we shift that to something dramatically different is really difficult when you're facing things like one road through a community. So what are the pathways to sort of, you know, build alternatives while we support people in that transition?
If I may, I'd love to build on what McKenna just said. I love your question on resilience because actually that word, and this is the writer in me coming out, that word was the one that stumped me the most in the process of writing this book. Like, what does it actually mean to be resilient? And what does it mean to be a resilient community? And it made me realize that resilience in so many ways, and this is something I'll talk more about at the talk tonight, resilience traditionally, if you look at the dictionary definition too, is, you know, measured by our ability to remain unchanged, to rebuild exactly what we lost in exactly the places that we lost it, rather than to be transformative and more imaginative and to actually look reality in the face and really rethink what it is that we're actually trying to be resilient for. And I think against, and I think also just language wise, I mean, you won't be able to unsee it, but like so much of our language about around climate change is kind of baked into these, like, there are so many like war-like analogies baked into the way we talk about climate change and nature, the fight against climate change, seawalls, coastal armoring. I'll say the words managed retreat. That is also baked into a very militaristic approach to our relationship to the ocean and to nature. And it doesn't have to be that way. And I'll fully admit my book titled California Against the Sea also gives a nod to that. But I don't think it necessarily has to be a battle with the ocean if we allow ourselves to take a step back and think about what it is that we actually want to be doing in terms of just acknowledging the realities of living along an ever-changing shoreline.
We have been hearing from Rosanna Shaw, environmental journalist with the Los Angeles Times and author of the book California Against the Sea. We also heard from McKenna Kaufman, director of the Institute for Sustainability and Resilience at the University of Hawaii. Shaw will be giving a talk at UH Manoa's Architecture Auditorium tonight at 6:30 if you want to find out more about what California is doing to deal with sea level rise and what we can learn from their policies. If you are unable to attend the free talk, we're told there it will be available as a podcast. We'll have links on our website later today. In a nod to the Year of Our Community Forests, we have been featuring stories about the conservation work at the National Tropical Botanical Garden, and in particular this week, the Breadfruit Institute. Today we head over to the island of Hawaii, where the Ulu Cooperative has been busy scaling up. Think Ulu flour and pancake mix. Could Ulu be turning up on school lunch trays? Donna Shapiro is the CEO of the Ulu Cooperative. We recently spoke with her about plans for an Ulu-filled future.
We have about 180 farmers across the state, and collectively they've planted about 7,000 ulu trees, with many of those trees having just gone in the ground really over the last 2 to 3 years. So we've had a huge increase in our production volumes. I think last time we spoke in 2020 or 2021, we were at about 90,000 pounds per year of ulu. And this year, so far since the season started over the summer, we've brought in more than 200,000 pounds. So our volumes have more than doubled. And over the next 5 years, we expect them to surpass 500,000 pounds per year. And by 2035, we expect about 1,000,000 pounds per year. So the volumes have grown a lot, and they're not done growing. We're on a growth trajectory as far as our farmers' supply. So that's number one. That's super exciting. And on the flower front, I think last time we spoke, we were at a production volume of about 2,500 pounds per year of ulu flower. And this year, we're on track to produce about 13,000 pounds. So huge increase in ulu flower production. It's become a larger percentage of our overall production and revenues and all that stuff.
So who's using it?
Our flower is going to a diverse mix of different types of customers all around Hawaii. It's pretty much exclusively distributed in Hawaii, and the customers include restaurants, grocery stores, food hubs, local manufacturers turning the flower into other value-added products, institutions like hospitals and schools, and lots of individual home buyers that are buying the product from our website or finding it at local grocery stores. So a really diverse mix of end customers.
So that must just be so satisfying to know that you are well on your way to scaling up.
It's exciting. It's really exciting to see it all kind of come together. People can go on our website, eatbreadfruit.com, and they can buy pure ulu flour. They can also find an all-purpose baking mix that's about 25% ulu flour combined with a few other gluten-free ingredients that make the flour work just like wheat flour. So it's really easy to use the all-purpose mix to create anything you would use regular wheat flour for. Whereas pure ulu flour is different. It's like pure rice flour or pure tapioca starch or something. It's more of an ingredient. It's not a one-to-one with wheat flour, if that makes sense. You can use ulu flour on its own for certain applications, such as thickening sauces. It's great if you want to thicken gravy and have it be gluten-free or just local. It can also be used on its own as a breading. So like in a tempura batter or katsu chicken or something like that,
oh, interesting.
You can use your ulu flour.
Wow, that is really exciting to just to, you know, try different things when you're in the kitchen.
Yeah, and we have a lot of recipes on our website for both the pure ulu flour and the all-purpose mix. So if you're not sure where to get started, you can find all of that at eatbreadfruit.com. And I just want to highlight our newest product. We launched it in November. It's an ulu flour pancake mix. And there's a recipe on the back. It's gluten-free, and it makes really delicious, fluffy pancakes. And it's about 25% ulu flour as well.
Well, what's on your wish list for the future?
One exciting project is we did develop several ulu and ulu flour recipes for DOE last year in partnership with Dr. Lauren Tamamoto from KCC, and we were able to present them to the menu planning committee and a panel of middle schoolers to taste test, and they were really positively received, especially some of the ulu flour recipes. And so we're hopeful that some of those will materialize. We've been in continued conversation with DOE about piloting some more recipes, so really excited to see some of those actually make their way into local cafeterias eventually. Some other exciting partnerships include some of the local manufacturers that we've been supplying, such as Aloha Bites. Aloha Bites recently launched a set of gluten-free mixes. They have a cupcake mix, a breading mix, but they're basically using our ulu flour to make all these fun mixes for local consumers to easily use at home and super delicious. On the frozen side, we also have several awesome manufacturing partners, including one of the newest ones is Hawaiian Crunch. It's a granola company out of Maui, and they're taking our frozen ulu and kalo and dehydrating it and mixing it into a local granola with a bunch of other local ingredients like macadamia nuts and local honey. And so that's now available on our website and at other local shops. So it's just really exciting to see what partnerships with other food producers in the community can create in terms of a whole new set of really fun, innovative, nutritious, and delicious products for locals and visitors to enjoy.
Well, all this talk about food, you're making me hungry. But, you know, we were just recently there on Maui at the Product Development Center there at Maui College, and then also took a tour of the Waihewa Center as well. That's just amazing what is available to young entrepreneurs who want to create a new product.
Yeah, absolutely. On our facility side of things, we're focused on making some big infrastructure improvements, both in Kona and in Hilo. Those are our two Hawaii Island facilities, just to keep up with our farmers' supply. And we've definitely been working with both Maui and Waihewa just to learn from some of the different equipment options they have. We've even been able to do a little bit of equipment testing at Maui and hope to do some at Waihewa as well.
it was exciting to learn about the hyperbaric machine and how that could possibly prolong the life of Ulu hummus. It's just a great opportunity, I think, for startups. And then is there anything else that you want to say just about potential farmers out there or folks who, backyard farmers who may want to plant a few trees just because you need the volume?
Yeah, we have a farmer-focused website called ulu.coop. So it's a different website, ulu.coop, and it has a lot of farmer technical support resources as well as some funding opportunities on there. If there are farmers interested or backyard growers interested in planting ulu trees or have questions about production practices, there's so many great resources on ulu.coop. There's a whole production primer for ulu where it's like everything you need to know to start an ulu farm. So encourage folks who are interested or have questions to just check that out. And I think a few months ago, maybe a year ago, Catherine, you had us on to talk about the expanding agroforestry project when it was just launching. This is a funding opportunity for Hawaii farmers run by the Nature Conservancy, and the Ulu Co-op is the local partner to administer the grant. We had a first cycle just over a year ago, and 8 awardees from Hawaii received the grant, and the second cycle is opening in just a few weeks. So if folks have questions on that, they can also visit ulu.coop for all the latest updates and the application link. But that second cycle is about to launch. So that's a great opportunity for commercial producers, specifically folks that want to get into ulu farming or expand their existing farm to include ulu, could be a good opportunity for them.
That was Ulu Cooperative CEO Donna Shapiro. The cooperative's farmers have harvested more than 2 million pounds of ulu since starting in 2016. We will have links to find out more on the conversation page of our website after the show. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, we take a closer look at the point in time count that's coming up and the decision to only count those housed in shelters. What do you think of the change? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.